Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur. Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 323 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyra, your host once again. And before I introduce my guest today, I'm going to do something completely different. You know, it's the summertime. I've been chilling out for a little while. I'm going to tell you, I watched Lincoln Lawyer, binge-watched Lincoln Lawyer on Netflix. Highly recommend it. Really good. And what I really liked about it is the courtroom scenes were pretty accurate depictions of what really goes on in a courtroom. Not 100% accurate, but pretty darn accurate. So completely as an aside, if you're interested in those kinds of things, check out Lincoln Lawyer on Netflix. So today, speaking of lawyers, my guest is Gerard Verga. And Gerard is the managing director of a law firm in Central and Northern Florida that spans six different locations, and this is the second law firm that he built. He built one to start with, and then that separated and dissolved, and he built a second one, as I said, to include a number of attorneys and staff spread out over six locations. So we're going to spend some time talking about how that happened, what things he used and took advantage of to achieve that growth, what his views are about the work-life balance and customer relations and all those things that are important for growing a law firm to the successful practice that he has done. So without any further delay, here is Gerard Verga. Gerard Verga, welcome to The Law Entrepreneur.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, it's a delight to have you here with us today, Gerard. Tell our audience a little bit about yourself and how you came to be where you are today.
Well, I'm the managing partner of the Verga Law Firm. We have offices in Pensacola, Fort Walton Beach, Florida, Navarre, Panama City, Panama City Beach, and Orlando, Florida. And I started off as a law clerk for Senator Sessions and then on to the Attorney General's office after graduation and made my way into private practice in Panama City Beach, working for some practitioners. And back in 2005, I decided to go solo after about 2 years of being a lawyer and wanted to have a better connection with my clients and see my vision out.
Well, it's pretty spectacular growth. You started in 2005, so what, 17 years now?
So I'd say 17 years, I guess, with a speed bump. My very first practice was the Verga Law Offices. And I got married and my ex-wife now was a lawyer and she came to work there and we went our separate way. And I basically left her that practice and started over with the Verga Law Firm in 2015. So I've grown the Verga Law Firm to have all these locations. We're up to 13 attorneys and about 40 support staff in just that short period of time, like the last 7 years.
I mean, I think that's actually a great story because, you know, you had a startup solo practice that you grew from grassroots. And then, you know, look, the dissolution of a law firm happens for a number of different reasons. Sometimes it's the death of a partner. Sometimes, you know, there are financial issues that cause it. Sometimes, like, you know, you're working with your spouse and you decide to go different ways. So you were able to navigate that process, which in and of itself is a challenge. You know, forget the whole family law divorce aspect of it. Winding down a practice that's associated with that relationship is a challenge in and of itself. and then jump back in, start another firm, build that from essentially scratch. You might have had some carryover, but build that up to where you are today. That's a hell of an accomplishment, George.
Thank you. Thank you.
There's nothing to sneeze at.
I have a person that works with me. He's an attorney, and he got an MBA. And he asked me, have you ever considered getting your MBA? And I said, Mike, I said, I got my MBA from the School of Hard Knocks.
There you go. Yeah, exactly. So let's roll back time a little bit. We'll start with coming out of law school. You worked for a couple of practitioners that you said. What area of law were you practicing in at the time?
Well, you know, I worked at the Attorney General's office for about a year, and then I ultimately got back to Panama City, and I was doing some family and some criminal law.
Right.
And, you know, at that time, I really thought I was going to go into ultimately some kind of a personal injury and make my way over there. And he had asked me in law school, do you want to be a family law attorney? I would have told you absolutely not. You know, I was not thinking that was going to be my career path. But once I started to do family law and I had a chance to see how it really affects people's lives, their kids, their homes, their retirements, and how personal it is to them, you know, I felt like that was, you know, something that was rewarding. It doesn't have necessarily all the zeros at the end of a personal injury settlement, but knowing that you've made a difference in a kid's life or a person's life in that way, in that intimate relationship, and how that child grows up, you know, steered me toward it. One time we were at a restaurant and I had a young lady, you know, probably around college age, high school age, came up and hugged me from behind. And my wife at the time kind of was like, what's going on? And I was kind of figuring it out. I was like, who are you? And I looked over and it was one of my clients, and the child had been in a bad situation where the mother had ended up getting addicted to drugs and was in an abusive relationship. And we had to fight hard to get that child into his custody and care. And the child hugged me and told me, like, you changed my life.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why I do it. And that's what motivates me, is trying to help people.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, in terms of as an ex-personal injury attorney at one time, you know, not all the personal injury cases have a lot of zeros behind them. Some of them are pretty bread and butter, you know, car accident cases. You got to go through a lot of those to score, you know, some of the big ones. But I find it's interesting that people have, you know, they're either in one camp or the other when it comes to family law. They either feel like it's the worst area of practice ever because you just so much turmoil and sometimes misery, and some of that's transferred to the attorney. On the other hand, there's so much you can do to directly affect, as you said, a person's life and to make it as good as it possibly can be under those circumstances. And you either love that or you hate it. And so I find most of the good family law attorneys, people like yourself who've made, you know, a success out of that practice, they do so because they really love how they can help people. Not that they want to screw the other spouse or, you know, stick it to them, but it's because they can help people.
I think, you know, with family law, the law is complicated because you're basically doing, you know, people don't realize that, but you're doing several suits in one. You're doing a dissolution of marriage. You're doing an alimony case. You're doing a custody case. You're doing an attorney's fees. You're doing a partition. So it touches all these wide gamuts of law. You know, even taxation issues come up. But it's the raw emotion that cases bring. And, you know, like Florida, where I'm at, we're a no-fault state, and people inside have this sense of moral justice that they've been wronged. And then you're in a no-fault system, which breeds a lot of frustration because it doesn't line up with their sense of right. And, you know, and then sometimes the outrage is taken out on you. Sometimes they're crying. When I interview people, I love to tell the story. My very first day kind of practicing family law as a law clerk, you know, doing a helping with a case, it was two paralegals in the office, and they were both female, and the attorney was out, and I was there, and I was the only other male. So I picked the phone up, and she heard a man's voice, his client, and she's like, USOB. And, you know, she started yelling, and I was taken back. I was like, no one in law school trained me to deal with this. And I tell new attorneys or paralegals or people who are entering this line of law, you know, Can you deal with the emotions? Do you have the thick skin? Do you know that this person, what they're going through, do you have that kind of empathy? And to use that to help them. By the end of the day, the client who had called me the SOB, who thought I was the attorney and was blaming me for her case, was apologetic and glad and happy. And we had our motion filed and, you know, and referred me cases later when I was on my own. You know, it's, you know, caring for the person, even when sometimes when it's difficult to love them.
You know? Yeah. And I think that's what, as I said, I think that's what sets apart the good family law attorneys from those who are just, you know, going through the motions. I know when I was doing family law, I did a lot of work with, you know, single mothers, mostly mothers, some cases fathers, who were in abusive relationships and just who felt that they didn't have any way out. They didn't know how to navigate getting out of the relationship and felt trapped. And being able to help somebody work through that, yeah, there's some emotional baggage that comes along. But at the end of the day, you can look yourself in the mirror and say, you know, I really helped another human being. And I think that as long as you can do that, you're going to find that family law can be, you know, very rewarding. On top of that, every case, every family is a different story. You know, there are some similarities between one case or another, but in general, everybody's got their own story. You know, their family is unique. Their situation is unique. And you're not presented with the same thing day in and day out.
I think the uniqueness gives the lawyer a real opportunity to, you know, to shine. How can I apply these facts to this body of law? How can I get creative in the application of it to tell my client's story? Because ultimately, at the end of the day, I think a family law attorney or honestly, any litigator has to be a great storyteller. You are snipping together no different than like a director takes pieces of film from the cutting room floor. I'm taking those facts. I'm taking that story. I'm taking that emotion and putting it into something, hopefully, that'll captivate the judge, hold his attention or her attention for the period of time and leave a mark on them and get past the law and get to a little bit of humanity, because that's really what they want is they want the judge to follow the law. We all do. But they also want the judge to see the human element of a family, of what's happened, the sacrifices they've made in the marriage or to child rearing, and to tell that story and turn them into people.
Well, I think we as a profession, we need to do a better job of positioning our profession in a way that brings honor to the profession and not disdain. Because when you ask the general public what they think about attorneys, we are so far down on the respect ladder that it's not funny. In fact, I know Mike Mogul at Chris Video presented a slide at the Game Changer Summit in Atlanta, which if any of our listeners are considering going, I highly recommend. I remember he presented a slide one time about a survey that was taken that ranked professions in terms of their respect by the general public. And lawyers ranked below prostitutes.
I would doubt it. I've had people say, you know, I've heard people say, you are a prostitute. You'll take anybody's money and say whatever you want them to say.
And when you say, okay, what kind of lawyer makes you feel that way? Or they say, well, you know, the family law lawyer, they're just scum. And then the ambulance chasers, you know, the personal injury lawyers. But, you know, everybody says that until they need an attorney. And if you had a family member that was in a serious accident, you'd want a really good personal injury attorney to help you try and right a wrong that the only way we can right it is by compensating you financially. And if you are a person who had a family law issue, you want an attorney who can listen to you and treat you with some humanity and try and get you the best outcome possible. So I think we do a terrible job of describing ourselves or positioning ourselves with the general public because, you know, in essence, we're not highly thought of.
One of my mantras at work with the attorneys I work with and the staff is, you know, I say it all the time, changing the way people think about lawyers one case at a time. Mm-hmm. Each decision you make on each telephone call, on your communication with, on, you know, showing them who you are and that you're a person and that you can relate to this, or maybe you've been divorced and you've been in their shoes, or you've been on the opposite of the table. And, you know, talking to them like they're people. I had one lawyer in the middle of a meeting. He said, well, then my lawyer brain kicks on. I stopped him. I shut him down. Mm. I was like, that's where you go wrong. Like, people do not like lawyers. People don't like talking to lawyers. Mm-hmm. You know, people want people. They want compassion. They want empathy. They want understanding. And they want to know that you care. I said, the rest of it is, you know, for us in the recesses of our lawyer brains to think about when they're not around. But when you're talking to them, you know, they want you to care. They want you to fight. They want to know that you're going to feel that pain and your that passion when you go to court. So I tell people all the time at work, when you're dealing with the clients, when you're talking to people, this is not law school. No one's mm-hmm. grading you on your lawyer speech and, you know, be a person.
I always felt that if I could help them understand, if I could help educate them in a non, you know, patriotical way, if I could just make the subject simpler and the rationale more obvious, then I've promoted what the law really is intending to do.
Yeah. Some of my favorite things is to take a client, because you got to think in family law, for people who haven't done it, these are not savvy insurance adjusters. They're not corporate counsel that you're working with in litigation case. There's limited funds. There's limited understanding of the law. And I try to boil it down into, sometimes it might be a little folksy, but I tell people sometimes they're griping about the outcome, or what I'm telling them the outcome is going to look like as to alimony or as to a custody case. And I tell them a lot of times, like, I use the example of, I may not want to drive down Highway 98 at 55 miles an hour. I may think that's stupid. I may want to go 75 miles an hour, but nobody's asked me my opinion. I said, I'm more like a baseball player or a football player. There are certain rules that are in play that I have to follow. And I was like, I'm not the one who gets to make the rules. I'm the one who has to use the rules to our advantage to try to win the game.
Yeah.
I was like, but I don't get to make these rules. And I joke around, and by the end of it, if I can get them laughing, I said, if you want to elect me to the state legislature, mm-hmm. I'll be glad to come up with a new set of rules. But until then, you know, you're at the wrong office. You need to go down and talk to the state representative about changing these things.
Well, you know, I will tell you, I recently spoke to a family law attorney here locally who was doing something I thought was really innovative, and she was taking her clients to family court to observe another case prior to their own case. And the idea was to get them to have some exposure to what really happens in a, you know, a scheduling hearing or a pendente lite hearing or just so that they'd have some understanding of what to expect, because for the most part, it's the first time our clients have ever been in a courtroom, and they don't know what to expect, and they base it on what they see on, you know, TV and the movies. And as you know, that's a far cry from what a real courtroom often looks like.
It's funny you say that, because when I do consultations now, and the client starting to commit to hire us, or we're getting into more of the details of things, I tell them this is not Perry Mason.
Right.
Your spouse is not going to take the stand and admit that they're a horrible parent, or we're a lousy husband, or it's not going to happen the way, and it's not going to be wrapped up in 30 minutes. I think a lot of people have this idea of how succinct this is going to be. And when I tell them you're looking at a year to 18 months on most cases that people really decide to fight, they're shocked. And, you know, but there is this expectation that of almost like a glamorized TV version of court, or we have a case coming up and the judge decided they were going to do a contempt and modification of temporary custody of children in 30 minutes, 15 minutes per side, 7 minutes for direct, 7 minutes for cross. And the client's talking to me about the witnesses. And I'm having to have the reality of,
if I know witnesses
two or three questions from you, maybe, and that's about all we're going to get. And they're outraged. But the legal system, especially with family law, there's not a whole lot of, sometimes enough time or lengthy hearings for some of these temporary issues.
Well, I do have to tell you, though, Gerard, you are dating yourself when you're referencing Perry Mason as the icon for the courtroom drama.
Well, I think they think that a lot of times I'm going to get in there and they're going to, like, I've had some very
powerful. That's a long time ago, Perry Mason was on.
I've had some, you know, powerful cross-examinations, but, you know, nothing where, you know, anyone has ever admitted I'm the one who did it, or, you know, and that's what they think is going to happen. And people will look at me in these family law cases, the clients, well, aren't they going to tell the truth?
Right.
And I'm like, well, it's like, you know, the truth is in the eye of the beholder sometimes. And, you know, I mean, we're going to lock them down on these facts, and, you know, the judge will be able to connect the dots, hopefully, and hear the story. But it's always entertaining. You never know what you're going to get. And a lot of times I do, if we don't go down to the courtroom or we don't watch maybe a video of a proceeding, which I think is a very useful tool. I sometimes, if I have a client that's very tenacious and doesn't want to talk about settlement, and they think they have the money to go on and litigate and keep litigating this, I love to sometimes sit them down and just cross examine them as hard as I possibly can. And then sometimes when we're at the end of that, you kind of see the blank look on their face of like, what just happened? And you know, they can't see, only they can only see their side of the story. They can't see all of it. And, you know, so I'm opening their eyes to that before we get to court. And it is a really bad outcome for them, pointing out these weaknesses in the case and being honest with them.
Right. You know, they've had that epiphany.
If you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time, because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. This episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you in part by the net profit CFO, Ryan Kimler. If that name sounds familiar, you might remember him as being a guest on episode 306 of The Law Entrepreneur, where we talked about his new company and how they can help you drive profit to your bottom line. I was so enamored by what Ryan had to say that I actually became a client. I called him up and said, I'm ready to take advantage of your expertise. And that's exactly what happened. So I'm now a very happy customer or client of the Net Profit CFO. But I'm also very pleased to welcome them as a sponsor to the show. So do you want to enjoy higher net profits without working longer or harder? As you learned in that previous episode, with just 9 simple numbers, Ryan will help you drive more profit to your bottom line, and he won't confuse you with all the details. If you want to increase your net profit, but don't like getting deep into the numbers, I highly recommend that you connect with Ryan. You can do that by going to netprofitcfo.com and download the Financial Clarity Dashboard. It's a great tool for getting the big picture of your financials. So we got off on a tangent there, which is fine. I'm happy to do that. But I want to find out more about how your law firm was able to grow to the size it is today. You know, when you reopened under the Virgo Law Firm banner, you opened, did you say what, Panama City?
Yeah, Panama City was the first office.
So, and now you're in 5 different locations or 6?
We're in Panama City. Panama City Beach is probably one location, really, because it's the same town, but sometimes people don't like to cross the bridge. Pensacola, Fort Walton, you know, Navarre, which is in Santa Rosa County, and then Orlando as well.
So, I mean, you're somewhat spread out across Central Florida, right?
Yeah, we're in spread around North Florida, and working our way now through hopefully the Central Florida area is the goal.
So, how do you go about that growth? What was key to you being able to grow from one location to 5 or 6?
You know, I think it's the same thing that you face when you decide you're going to go out on your own. If you don't believe in you and you won't invest, you know, in your dream and your goal, then others will not follow, whether it be clients who come in if you don't believe in yourself and your product. And I had a good product in Panama City. I had reached about 185 cases on as a solo attorney with some paralegals and staff. And so we hired some attorneys there. And I started to get phone calls, you know, leading out toward Fort Walton, Pensacola area. And I decided, hey, I'm going to give this a shot. I took, you know, office with low overhead in Fort Walton first, and then eventually over in Pensacola, you know, keep the overhead low in the beginning. But, you know, be confident in your vision and your dream enough to invest so you don't set yourself up for failure. You know, you need a receptionist or some sort of support staff to bring it to life, you know, and, you know, then we, you know, I would go over there a couple of days a week and then ultimately had a full-time attorney. And then when Pensacola came on board, we kind of followed the same model. And it was one of those things where, you know, in the beginning of the practice, when I first went on my own back in 2005, you know, I had a lot of respect for my boss, but we practiced all very differently. I'm very compassionate, open, and I'll talk to my clients on my cell phone. I'm an open book with them. I want them to trust me, and I want to be treated like a person, and I know they want to be treated like a person, and I try to build that relationship. And so as we expand it, you know, I think the number one thing that, you know, to keep in mind is anybody can run an office, but you have to have the people who share the same vision and goal as you. You can train anybody to be an attorney or a paralegal, but you can't train someone to say, I have the same ambition and goal and to share your firm's values. And finding those people, I think, is the real key to success, is having the right people who share those values. And if people don't share your values, that's fine. This may not be the firm for them, though. They may need to do their own thing.
So you grew this practice up organically, and you added these other locations as the need arose. But I mean, at the end of the day, you can have all the confidence in yourself and the belief in your own abilities in the world, but the phone calls have to come from somewhere.
Oh, yeah. Well, in the beginning, I had, you know, Panama City, that's where I was from, you know, I had been practicing there before. So I had some organic, you know, growth. And then I had some spread, you know, the panhandle of Florida, you know, you have military bases, people transferring. So I was starting to get some nibbles out there. But, you know, I'm a big believer in marketing. I believe we are not always, people think, you know, what do you do? I'm a lawyer. And I told my work, no, number one, you're a marketer. Number two, you're a lawyer.
Yeah.
You know, it's, I had a friend who told me this story and I never have forgot it. He was talking about Kodak and, you know, Kodak was, you know, in the film business, and they're not, you don't see Kodak anymore. I don't even know if it's still around. They forgot they're in the picture business. Our product is ourselves, and we have to market ourselves, and you have to set the appropriate image and, you know, lay out your product on your website. And, you know, I would say that it's instrumental to have a great marketing team. On our website, I use Scorpion as our company out of, I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they do an excellent job with marketing and pay-per-click and digital marketing out there.
Did you start with Scorpion in the very beginning, or have you gone
in the very beginning?
Really?
Yours truly took a class in college about basic web design. Uh-huh. And the first website I had, I coded it by hand in Notepad. I could not afford Scorpion in the very, very beginning, a year or two out of law school, but I worked my way up to that. And even still today, when I talk with other lawyers or even some lawyers in the firm, we spend X amount of dollars and, you know, they're, and I was like, yes, you know, we do, because it's a return on the investment. And if you're going to go that path and you're going to do digital and you're going to do websites and you're going to do Google, you know, you can read Lexis and Westlaw all day long and you should be doing those things and become a good lawyer, but you have to understand how that stuff works yourself. And you have to have intelligent conversations with the company you choose, if you know, whether it be Scorpion or someone else. And you have to be innovating. Technology is always changing. When I first started practicing, I had a client who was not so nice. And then later on, he apologized and said, I didn't know you were a real lawyer. I didn't realize you had your picture in the phone book. and so I laughed about that, you know, and then a few years later, nobody was, you know, worrying about the phone book, and we were all on the internet. And, you know, I think I work with Haley Smith over at Scorpion, who's been a good teammate. I like to think of her as part of the team. And she'll always say, you know, you're always ahead of the curve, or you're always thinking about what's next. And one day I came home when they first introduced like the Google Home and Alexa, and I bought a few of these homes. My wife said, what are you doing? I said, I'm going to ask them who's the best law firm. And, well, Alexa, I need a divorce. And she said, you think people are really doing that? I said, no, they're not. Not today, probably, but they will be. And now I look at my kids and that's all they do. I'm sitting here looking at my phone. They just start talking and get the answers they want. And, you know, you have to always see how the technology is changing and how you have to ride that wave, as, you know, we live in a age of great change when it comes to communication and information, and being at the top of that, you know, is the key, you know.
Well, there's no question that your website and all your other products that you generate all have that consistent look and feel. Obviously, Scorpion's done a great job for you over the years, because as somebody once told me, the public has very difficult for them to be able to tell which lawyer is better than another. In fact, it's impossible. They need to be able to look at your website, look at your promotional products, look at your advertising, all of those things, your brand, and feel connected with you, feel like they know you.
I think the website is a great way to get people, you know, mm-hmm. to know you are, to take the initial interest. But I think you have to think of it as it's a multi-faceted approach to converting someone from a lead to a client. And, you know, a few years back, we were talking, you know, at work, and I said, I'm going to hire some phone people and then, you know, work on the phones and the leads. And the paralegal's like, well, we're going to get paralegals? And I'm like, no, absolutely not. And her mouth kind of dropped, but what are you going to get? I was like, we're going to get people who've done sales. We're going to get people who've worked in customer service. And then we'll have you sit there, you know, close to them and monitor and teach and guide. And, you know, in 6 months from now, sure, they'll know, you know, a little bit more, and it'll get better and better. But at the end of the day, you have to convert people over. And I look at a lot of like trade journals, and there was a guy who he was a great marketer for Callaway golf clubs, Pepsi, and he retired to Florida. And he said, I got tired of playing golf. My wife was wanted me to do something else. And he said, so I picked up some lawyer clients. 80% of he said all his tactics that he had from these big products didn't work. And he said, at the end of the day, what he found out was usually who they see first, who they feel comfortable with first, gets the call. And then 80% of the conversion is, did the person who picked up the phone show them attention, warmth, compassion, or did they put them on hold or act like it's a difficulty? Yeah. In our practice, we do same day consults unless the client asks for otherwise. Same day. Unless you ask for a different date. Because if you have a problem that's pressing and you have decided to pick up the phone and call the attorney,
we don't want to let them go.
Yeah, you don't want to let them go because you're going to, you know, it puts them back into the marketplace for competition. But if the person's really that stressed and under that pressure, they're needing answers. And they need somebody they think they can get to and contact and will care. And, you know, I tell people it all the time, you know, if you're a lawyer and, you know, you work in a team like we do with them, you know, there's no bell, no magic bell at 5 o'clock. If they need to be here at 5:30 because of work or whatever, you know, we have to look at this. You know, lawyers have a tendency to put themselves on a pedestal, but at the end of the day, you have to look at the end product user's experience, the client's experience, and what they want, what they need. And, you know, to try to work with them because they're people just like you and I, and they're in a very scary situation a lot of times, whether it's family law or criminal law or personal injury, and they need somebody to count on.
Yeah. Now, with these offices spread out across these various locations, how do you keep your team all in communication with each other? How do you keep them, in essence, a team?
Well, how we do it is we've had Zoom for years before the pandemic.
Right.
So we were a big advocate of Zoom. We have used, you know, chat services like Microsoft Teams and things like that to communicate and to, you know, to talk to one another all day long if we want to. We do, you know, company parties at times. Right. You know, if you're in Orlando and the Christmas parties in Destin, up in the northern part of Florida, we bring everybody. Sometimes, periodically, we have crossed up kind of mentors. Like if you're working Fort Walton and there's a new attorney in Orlando, sometimes we, you know, build those relationships by, hey, you know, if you have a question, ask Mike over in Fort Walton, you know, to get people interacting with one another. And in fact, the lady who's our director of our Orlando office was a law clerk in Fort Walton who ended up wanted to move closer to her family back home in Lakeland, Florida. And so she ended up taking over the Orlando spot. And, you know, we try to keep it like a family of you know, connections and friends, and try not
about,
to.
And how about from a practical standpoint, do you have a centralized practice management system that governs the whole practice, or do you do it by office?
We go with Clio. Clio houses all the data for the case management. And then we have, you know, our centralized server as well, and our local backups, but everything is, you know, done through Clio. And I'm a big proponent of, I tell people all the time, if it's not in Clio, it didn't happen. And they, you know, as a part of the interview process, I tell people, you know, you're charting in that case, because ultimately what will happen is some client will get upset about something, they'll call me, and I'm going to Clio, and I want to be able to defend my members of my firm and the action they took and the decision they made. And, you know, they'll say, I haven't heard anything back. And I'm like, well, no, Clio shows me that they've messaged you five times and you haven't opened them. So, you know, I said, I'm your first line of defense, and Clio is the record. We had one client one time who was upset and at the end ultimately apologized, but used the bar complaint term, which, you know, every lawyer loves to hear. And I, you know, saw that he was not being accurate and they had been communicating. And I asked him, did he want me to print that out and send it to him or send it directly to the Florida bar? And he stopped and apologized and explained he didn't get to see his kids over Christmas. And he was just in a bad mood over that and hurt. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, that's the role of the family law attorney, you know, to get you past that and counsel you through it. And so I'm a big proponent of Clio. We use it for document storage. We use it for calendar. We use it for almost all communications with the client. We share documents with our clients, do that in real time as soon as they come across the electronic filing portal. We have one person who just mans the porthole for all the offices and immediately disseminates that information out to the clients in real time.
And do you bill out of Clio as well?
The actual cost of the software?
No. Do you bill the clients?
For the work being performed on it?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if we have somebody who's sending them the documents or you know, talking to them through Clio in lieu of the email, then of course we would bill a lot of times.
I mean, do you bill your clients on an hourly basis or a flat fee basis for their legal matters?
It depends on the client. We have some clients that we offer flat fees to, depending on the type of case it is, and you know, the attorney that you know they want at the firm. If you're have a bigger case and you have higher expectations and you want an attorney who is more seasoned, and you know, we have hourly as well. I try to leave the client the option as to what they can afford.
I'm just trying to get to the bottom. You send the client the bill out of Clio?
Yes. If it's an hourly bill, it goes through Clio as well.
Okay. Because there are some people who use Clio as a practice management tool, but don't use the billing services. They use something different. Like, you know, I know several people who grew their practice using QuickBooks. Mm-hmm. And so they have an interface between Clio Manage and QuickBooks, and they bill out of QuickBooks, but they manage out of Clio. I was just trying to figure out, you know, what you were doing.
We send the bill for the bills out in Clio. Mm-hmm. Our bookkeeper then kind of reconciles that with the QuickBooks. Right. And that way the accountant is happy because the accountant wants the QuickBooks, not the Clio.
Right, exactly. All right, and last but not least, tell me a little bit how you go about staffing these locations. Because as we hear from everybody around the country, staffing is a major challenge these days. And finding the right staff member can drive a firm owner crazy.
It has, and it will continue to. And I think, you know, what we do is, you know, we, after COVID or during COVID, we kind of reevaluated what we were doing. You know, I started off practicing. I went and got a handbook from the American Bar Association about how to run a law firm. And I can't say that jives anymore necessarily. And it's not the most, productive way, I think, of doing it. Obviously, you want to follow the ethical rules, but, mm-hmm. We opened it up to, 160 hours of leave, paid time off for everybody. Mm-hmm. It works there regardless of how long you've worked with us. We break it down into 2 1-week vacations every 6 months. So I think mental health for the employee, especially working in family law and the stress, you need a good week to recharge. We took that from a trade journal that a Fortune 500 companies were doing that on top of your 2 week vacations or your 2 1-week vacations. We also do another 80 hours of PTO, plus we have the courthouse holidays off. Right. And, we've tried to build a more flexible, accommodating place, with the employees to recognize that the world is changing and people need balance. But we use a lot of Indeed. We've used headhunters before, and it really comes down to it. Like I said, there's not going to actually be a perfect candidate.
Yeah.
You could have someone who's very seasoned and they're going to want to do it their way necessarily versus the firm's way, or they may not share the values that you have. So I will normally pick somebody with aptitude that shares the values and then, work on training and knowing that it's an investment. And if you see early signs that they don't share the values of the firm and they don't share the vision of the company, then you need to offboard them as fast as you hired them.
Well, I had somebody recently say to me, I'm always looking for great people, and when I find them, I hire them, and then I figure out how to use them.
Yep, that's true.
I thought that was pretty
you gotta be In the great resignation period, you got to be like MacGyver.
Yeah.
Pick them up and then figure out what their talents are and how to best implement them into the system.
Find the ones that work great with you and then figure out how to use them the best. So listen, Gerard, this has been great. It sounds like you got something really special going on down there in Florida. Tell our audience, what's the best way to reach out to you if they want to kind of follow up on anything you had to offer today?
You could go to our website and email me. Website is www.thevirgolawfirm.com, or you can call our office at 850-818-0236 if anybody has any questions about the practice of law.
Terrific. Well, we'll have all of that in the show notes. And next time I'm down there in Orlando knocking that little white ball around a little bit, I'll come give you a call, okay?
Sounds good. We're looking forward to it.
All right, Gerard. Thanks ever so much for being a guest today on The Law Entrepreneur.
Thank you, sir.
Well, there you have it, boys and girls, another episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors for this episode, our good friends at Ruby. I can't say enough about Ruby. As you know, they've been my virtual receptionist for years now. Couldn't be happier with them. And I really urge all of you, if you need a virtual receptionist, that you give Ruby a chance. Also, Net Profit CFO, as I've mentioned before, Ryan Kimler was a guest on the program some time ago. I liked what he had to say so much, I became a client. And then after I became a client, he became a sponsor. So very happy about that arrangement. If you want to take your understanding of your financials in your law firm to that next step beyond just what your bookkeeper gives you back, give Ryan a call at Net Profit CFO. I don't think you'll be disappointed. If you enjoyed this podcast, do me the great favor of leaving a positive rating and review wherever you listen to your podcast. It really helps with the opportunity for us to get in front of other people. And until next week, I wish you all the best, and we'll see you again here on Law Entrepreneur.